that working?
Well, let's see. You say his name is Reasonable Doubt?
Yeah.
What's the other one's name?
Liza Doolittle.
Okay.
Out of My Fair Lady.
We're interviewing Judge Gordon Bennett and Helena at his home. It's June 8th, 2005. Judge Bennett, you're from up in the northeastern part of Montana, up around Scobie.
Yep.
And you grew up there, I suppose, during the Depression era and that sort of thing. And I'm sure the influences of your boyhood contributed greatly to the development of your philosophy. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that.
My dad went up to Scobie probably in about 1912 or 13, when much of Daniels County was untilled. It was mostly grazing country, and he broke up a sizable portion of Daniels County because he went to the country and broke it up because he had this marvelous crop of grass, and the grass came up to his knees when he went up there to look at it. And I just came back from Scobie, and by George, on some of the prairies, it's the same as it was then. It was as green and beautiful as Ireland. He was attracted to that country. I was born in 1922, and I went through the eighth grade in Scobie and was there until 1936 approximately. And so I was born in a depression year, in a drought year, 1922, up in the northeastern corner of the state, but I wasn't much of a witness to it. But I was a witness to the Dirty 30s, all of them. My dad continued to farm up there well after the Dirty 30s, but in the 30s, we experienced the ugliness of Montana when it turns against you. And we had grasshoppers, and we had hailstorms, and we had dust storms, and we had drought. We had about everything you could have that would kill off a crop, and hope was almost gone. Hope was so slight in that corner of the world that communism had moved into the northeastern corner of the state. A full communist ticket was voted on in Plentywood, 50 miles away, in probably about 1932.
And they were successful, right?
Some of the communist candidates were elected. Don't ask me which ones, but I think there was some success.
There was a fellow named Red Flag Taylor?
Red Flag Taylor, right. I don't know whether Red Flag got elected, but he was the leader. He was a leader.
Did you ever meet him?
No, never meet him. If you want to know all about that, Larry Bowler is gone. The publisher and editor of the local paper, the Daniels County Leader, used to be an expert on them.
Yeah.
His name is Bowler. He's long since gone. But
you remember the despair that may have lent itself to this?
I remember that, well, it was a combination of things. It was a combination, one, of incurable optimism. There were people there that believed in the country and believed in it, but it was awfully hard to avoid despair. And there was a lot of despair. There was a lot of desperation. There was a lot of people that were sort of living off the land. There was no money around. And it was a very desperate time. And of course, you ask where my instincts come from. Part of them come from the fact that the advent of the Roosevelt administration really didn't cure much of anything, but somehow there was something about it that brought hope. And the famous speech of Roosevelt, "We have nothing to fear but fear itself," had an impact. That's the first political impression I ever had. that a leader like that could make a difference simply by the sound of his voice. I remember listening to that thing on the old radio. Wasn't very good transmission and it wasn't very good reception, but you could hear Franklin Roosevelt's voice. So that's where I got my first political impression. And it's where I got my first sort of approach to understanding about desperate people, what they could put up with and what they would react to and so on, because I was surrounded by them. And Scobie has come a long way since then.
Judge Bennett, did you know Ed Smith at that time, the longtime legislator from up there?
No. I didn't know him up there. I knew Ed Smith when he was down here.
I see.
Many years later. Yeah. But I didn't know Big Ed Smith at all. Heard about him from the very beginning.
I'm going to do a historical interview with him, and he's mentioned this same incident. He's a few years older than you. I think he was born in 1917 or 1918.
Yeah, and he was Plentywood guy.
But he remembers something about this too, and he told me that he said that we were all concerned. I don't want to take words out of his mouth because I haven't interviewed him yet, but I talked to him a little bit on the telephone. He said, gee, we were all concerned. It was a terrible and desperate time, but he said we were also frightened by what we perceived to be the radicalism of this outfit when they were avowedly communist that had taken over the county government. So he said what happened was the Democrats and the Republicans basically got together.
Yep.
And they, in the next two or three or four years, captured control of the county government back again.
And if I could be editorial about it, that's a lesson for our times. When you have people that go too far out on the right or the left, there is a tendency for the center to get together. And I think that happened up there. They weren't, that crowd were recognized as radicals. My dad, for instance, would have nothing whatever to do with them. He had wanted to have everything to do with people that were working, trying to do what they could, forming cooperatives and things like that. But the radical people scared him, and I think scared most of the other people there.
Mm-hmm.
But they were a force, and Big Ed Smith will assure you of that. They were a force.
Now, the Farmers Union was becoming an important force in state politics, too, during that period of time.
That's right.
Do you have any recollections about that? Even though did you say you moved away from there when you were in eighth grade?
Yeah, I moved away there from the eighth grade, but I worked on the farm, and essentially till I went to law school in 1950. I worked on the farm for many, many years. We had a couple of sections over in the Horseshoe Basin by Peerless. I'm having a senior moment, I'm forgetting the man's name. But we farmed next to the guy that had as much as anybody to do with the development and formation of the Farmers Union. He farmed over by Peerless. And when I was over there summer following on several occasions, his tractor would stop and about noon. And so I got to know him and I stopped my tractor and we used to sit down and talk together. And he was very active in the development of the Farmers Union, and we're talking now again about the radicals. He was kind of a radical. He'd no communist. I can assure you of that. He was no communist. I think borderline socialist, however. But he believed in cooperatives. He believed in people cooperating and so on. And he was very active. You know, people had the impression that the farmers out there farmed for about 6 months and then they didn't do anything. And during the long winter months, they'd read the Montgomery Ward catalog and the Sears and Roebuck catalog before they took it out to the back house. And they were ignorant farmers. This guy, Don Chapman was his name. Don Chapman was one of the most learned people I ever talked to. He had the classics. He had a funny little house out in there, out of Peerless there. Very unimpressive home ranch sort of thing. But in that house, I visited just one time. But my very distinct impression was that's the most literary farmhouse I ever saw. he had copies of newspapers spread all over the place, and he had the classics. He had a set of the classics books. He studied the classics, he studied economics, he studied politics, he studied society, and so on. And he was a learned, learned person. And Don Chapman had, as I say, as far as I know, as much to do with the founding and development of the Farmers Union in Montana as anybody. I used to share lunch with him. It was a great privilege.
And a philosopher, it sounds like.
He was a true philosopher. He was a practical philosopher. He wasn't a theoretical philosopher, but he could go back to the classic philosophers and quote them.
Now, Judge Bennett, I know this is an old memory, it's a boyhood memory. Is there a way, can you think of, that you could maybe capsulize his philosophy?
Well, today he would be looked on as a liberal. He believed in the people taking action, not only at the government level, but at the local level. He believed that people's salvation was in the people, and that they ought to take action. Now, he believed in, as I'm probably repeating here, he believed in community action, but he also believed in government action at the local level, state level, and the federal level. The Great Farm Program started coming along. He was entirely supportive of them.
He would have been supportive of them.
Oh, no question about it. For instance, one of the early farm programs, in my view, the farm programs today somewhat lack any rationality, except the resolution of political forces, but the first farm programs had to do with strip farming. They'd pay you to strip farm. That was highly practical, and it changed the nature of farming. Don Chapman was one of the early strip farmers. He believed in that, but the government subsidized it and changed the nature of farming in Montana, because strip farms don't blow like the great big section-wide farms that you had. And you talk about conservation. That was land conservation that won't quit. You can go in southwestern United States, New Mexico, and western Oklahoma, Texas. You can see where they didn't strip farm, that's still not recovered. The land still hasn't recovered. He believed in those programs. He believed in practical programs. He believed, well, they made a shibboleth of family farms. He believed in family farms, but the only family farms that are left, God bless Don Chapman's soul, are farms that belong to families, but they're big corporation farms that farm 10,000, 15,000 acres. They can combine 300 acres in one day.
Now, the farm programs were designed to try to keep the family on the farm, I guess, I don't know.
No, generation after generation, that was the shibboleth. That was the principal thing. They're still talking about family farms.
Right. Whatever happened, it doesn't seem to have worked. Is that what you're saying?
Well, it didn't work. Two things were going on in the farming business. Three things were going on. You had government programs. But a couple of other things that were going on is that farming is not an easy occupation. Farmers still live pretty close to the edge. while they're living. A lot of them leave multi-million dollar farms, but the cash flow isn't all that great. They just barely make it from year to year, and the farm gets more valuable. But it's a tough business, and young people growing up on farms tend to leave them and go off and search things in the city. So the one thing that's happened to farms is there were no one to take it over. A family would die out, essentially, and then the farm goes up for sale, so the neighbor buys it. And in that way, the farms got bigger and bigger and bigger. That wouldn't have happened except for the other thing, and that is the economics of farming. We bought a combine. We bought two combines after World War II. And they were used combines, but they were in very good shape. And I think we paid $600 or $700 for the combine. Last week I was up in Scobie, and I was talking to people who know a man who came out of my same era. He's a pretty old guy. But he followed the technological changes and the economic changes occasioned by the technological changes. He has three units now. He goes south and combines in the south because he has to pay for the combine. He has three combines that cost $250,000 apiece. And attached to them are $15,000, $20,000 semi-trucks. He's got $1 million capitalization. That's the other thing that's been happening to farming. I didn't understand what was going to happen. I thought, and Don Chapman thought, and a lot of other people thought, when these trends get going and are fully realized, what's going to happen is you'll just have great big corporation farms run by General Mills, because they're the only people that have the kind of capital that can do it.
Yeah.
That really hasn't happened. General Mills hasn't taken any great interest, at least in farming in Montana. But what has happened is that you have an accumulation of the real property interests. People are buying these farms that are being where the people are dying out, and then they're cooperative farming, sort of. They're sharecropping with the people that have the machinery. So it's all local, but it wouldn't be fair to characterize them as family farms. They're not a cozy little two or three man and his wife and two kids working on the farm with a half a dozen cattle and 850 acres. That's gone. They're big. When you put them all together, you put all these pieces together that they're both they've bought and they've rent. You're talking about a realistic farmer, the biggest one they know of up there. He farms strips of land all the way from Poplar to Canada, and he farms about 10,000 plus acres. That's what the farming is coming to. But he's picked up these pieces of land that families don't own anymore. He rents things and things like that. They're fitting the property, the real property, to the costs of operation. That's what's happening. That's what's evolved in my time.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose the acreages are larger in a place like Montana, where it takes a large amount of land to generate income. That is probably somewhat the case in Illinois, but probably not to as great an extent.
Yeah.
Because the land is more fertile and the rainfall is more predictable.
But the other thing is happening, and that is they're consolidating.
Yeah.
We have relatives in Minnesota who thought they had an awfully big farm. They had, I think, five quarters, meaning five quarter sections.
Uh-huh.
That was a big farm in western Minnesota. Those are being consolidated because they're facing the same thing. The machinery and the operation is increasing in size,
mm-hmm.
but they're not getting anywhere to the extent they are here. But they're not, well, they're dry land farms. They're dry land farms, but they have richer land and they have more rainfall. than they have in this part of the country. My point is this. You have, northeastern Montana is not the only place that has great big farms. Kansas, Nebraska,
sure, yeah,
and Texas all have huge, huge acreages now under one single control. Corporations. It's corporation, you know, it's maybe one family, but it's big corporation. It's financed like a corporation, and you may have stockholders in it, but you may have multiple interests that own the place and so on. So it's run like a corporation.
Why did you leave the farm?
Well, I left in steps. In 1936 was a particularly miserable year. This is 35, was 3 or 4 years into the Roosevelt administration, and you know, hope had arisen, but the weather wasn't cooperating very well. And I have two brothers, and my oldest brother was ready to go to college. And my mother, who had the usual mother influence, I wouldn't say she didn't care what happened, except for one thing, and that was her boys are going to get educated, period. We found out that you could go to the University of Oregon in Eugene if you were a resident without paying any tuition at all. And we had three boys to educate. So we went into a program of my mother and my two brothers and my sister. We would go out and we had a house. We rented a house in Oregon, in Eugene. And my dad hung on to the farm here. And he worked. My dad had to work full time almost for the Public Service Commission and other things. And the federal government, he bought out much of the wildlife refuge up around Plentywood. There's a big wildlife refuge out there. He spent many winters buying the land up there for the federal government. But he had to do all this extra work in order to save the farm, and we went out to Oregon to educate the kids. So we were there, and he was there, and he'd come out and visit us all the time, but that's the only way we could survive and get the kids educated.
So and your brothers and sisters went to the University of Oregon, or Oregon State? University of Oregon, I guess.
My oldest brother graduated, he took 5 years. He graduated as a CPA at the University of Oregon, but in during the war, we migrated back to Helena here, and my next oldest brother, I went to the University of Montana for a year, then he went to Cornell University and became a hotel manager. But we came back to Helena, and then moved to Saybrook, Connecticut for a while, and came back to Helena. So, the point is, as far as I'm concerned, my residence ended about 1936 in Scobie and went out doing other things. So, but we've kept track of it, and my brother, the CPA, went out, and he worked for Arthur Anderson in New York City, on Pine Street in New York City. And
people listening to this tape may not know, but Arthur Anderson was a national accounting firm that was involved in a major scandal here recently.
Arthur Anderson used to employ thousands of people. They employ about 250 people now. They were destroyed by the Enron.
Yeah. Enron was a big energy company that Arthur Anderson did the accounting for, and it was found that they, I don't know if it was proven or not, but it was widely suspected that they had cooked the books, so-called, and they ended up going down with Enron.
That's right. That's right. My brother worked for them in New York City, and he was an auditor of Schenley liquor accounts and things like that. One day he walked out of, one August day, he walked out of the building he was in on Pine Street, just off Wall Street in New York. He was doing very well as an accountant, and if he would have stayed with him, he probably would have done very well in the long run. But he walked out, and all at once he realized he was homesick. And at the same time, my dad was in the process of being disabled. And he came back, my older brother came back and ran the farm, until about, 6 or 8 years ago, when he sold out, 6 or 8 years ago. So he was there. So the family's been there. My point is, I've kept track of the country and so on. And just came back here from Scobie day before yesterday. You can't believe how beautiful it is.
That's wonderful.
You just can't believe how beautiful it is. And Scobie's a handsome little town.
Yes.
Sunday's Billings Gazette had a wonderful article on Scobie. I don't know whether you saw that.
No.
Front page article on Scobie. But it's a wonderful, friendly little town, wonderful people. They've developed it into a beautiful little community, a physically beautiful little community, and have a wonderful hospital. And it's quite a place.
Yeah. Not really part of our historical interview, Judge Bennett, but I just make a comment. When I was a small boy, we had a neighbor. My grandmother had a farm ranch operation up in the Flathead Valley, and one of her neighbors was an old fellow by the name of Alfred Evanscoss.
That's a Scobie name.
The Evanscoss family was from Scobie, and he used to, I remember when I was a little boy, he'd talk about Scobie kinds of things.
Yeah.
And he was very Norwegian and a very nice and kindly old gentleman.
Yeah. He probably represented Scobie as good as anybody could. Heavily Norwegian.
Yes.
Area. Scandinavian, generally. Swedes, Norwegians, some Danes, and so on. Big Scandinavian influence. Wonderful people, wonderful citizens. I think that's why it's such a good town. It's a little like, I think, I don't know what I'm talking about, but I think it's a little like a Scandinavian town.
Probably so, yeah.
Yeah.
Probably so. So you probably could have become a farmer.
Oh, yeah, I worked at it very hard from the time I was about 10 years old till I was nearly 30. I got my hands dirty.
And so, but you were motivated to go to law school.
Well, when the war came along, my dad developed a wonderful combination for a farmer. He had good crops and high prices. And my dad loved to eat, and he loved to go to theaters. And Pate, my older brother, was back in New York. And my dad would go back and visit him and eat good things and see some plays in New York. And he decided that they'd like to take a home. And they got a home that was on Saybrook Point, Connecticut. It was halfway between Boston and New York. It was an hour and a half commuting train out of New York City. And my dad could get down and spend the evening going to the, my dad and my mother could spend the evening going down, seeing the theater and having a good meal and come back to Saybrook, where it was a little local. I tell you that to let you know that when I got out of the Army, I finished up at Carleton College in Northfield, Minnesota, in economics. And I really didn't know what the heck I wanted to do. But I went and I helped them rebuild the house they bought in Connecticut. And during the winter I did that, I read the New York Times every morning, and I decided the only thing to do in the world is to become a journalist.
Okay.
So I went to the University of Missouri and got a master's degree in journalism. And I came back, and to make a long story short, I went to work for the Great Falls Tribune and worked there for a year and a half or so.
That was in the early 1950s?
Yeah. We're still in the 51, 52.
And that was, of course, when the Anaconda Company owned the daily papers in the state, most of them, except for the
Great except Falls for Tribune. The Tribune. Yeah.
Is that did that was that important? I mean, do you remember hearing that discussed? Was that the Great Falls Tribune? Was it proud of the fact that it was independent of the Anaconda Company, or?
Well, they were very proud of it on the Tribune, but the state in general wasn't very proud. You know, the state, the people in the state weren't really bothered by the Anaconda Company. The Anaconda Company, one of the Anaconda Company's leading editors was Duane Bowler, the son of the publisher of the Daniels County Leader. And I got to know quite a bit about the Anaconda Company and how they operated. But it was a terrible newspaper operation. They would suppress stories, they would leave stories out, important stories. It was a policy paper. But toward the end of their...
What do you mean policy paper?
Oh, shoot. For instance, they're reporting on the legislature. You wouldn't have any idea what the legislature is doing if you're reading the Anaconda papers. On the one hand, they'd leave out half of it, and the other hand, they'd overemphasize the other half of it. They developed, I think, a little of this intellectual thing that we have in Montana, which is powerful. Everybody's against taxes. They were, that influence is disappearing, of course, with the passage of time. But this state was brainwashed on the subject of taxes by the Anaconda papers. And Doc Bowler got to be the managing editor of the Billings Gazette, their biggest paper. And he was always a rebel. He was like his old man. But he used to tell me about the huge change there was. He was an editor of the Independent Record when it was owned by the Anaconda Company, and he saw the transition to the Lee newspapers.
And do you remember how he described that?
Oh yeah. Well, he described it in lots and lots of ways. He was a terrible rebel as far as the Anaconda Company was concerned. He just barely hung on because he was like his old man, as I say. He had powerful sort of independent streak. And the Anaconda Company papers wasn't a place where he wanted an independent guy. He wasn't comfortable there at all. When the Lee newspapers came along, he was almost liberated. He was still a rebel, still an independent thinker, but you could do that and get away with it on the Lee newspapers. In the Anaconda Company papers, he would bring a story, he'd bring a story in from the legislature when he was working here as an editor on the, he used to cover the legislature. He'd bring a hot story in, and he'd find, much to his surprise, that it didn't show up in the next morning's paper.
Now, I remember, we're talking about Doc Bowler.
Doc Bowler.
Well, I remember him, he wasn't particularly a political liberal, was he? Maybe he was just more of an independent. I don't remember him as a...
You couldn't label Doc.
But he wrote editorials that I think, some of them were conservative, as I remember.
Some of them were conservative, and I think some of them were liberal.
Yeah, that's
depends
how
on how you want to know.
Yeah.
He didn't feed at either one of those troughs. He didn't feed at anybody's trough. Doc was, name was Duane, but his, Ewan was,
yeah.
Doc.
Yeah.
Doc was maybe the most independent son of a gun I've ever known on his thinking. I used to drink beer with him on Leslie Street here for years.
Yeah.
Loved to talk to Doc, because half of the time I disagreed with him totally, and the other half he disagreed with me. But he was, whatever his position was, he'd thought it out at great length.
Yes.
It reminded me of the old saying that somebody made, and that is, well, I don't know where I am on that issue, but I'll tell you this. When I decide where I am, I'm going to be serious about it.
Did he ever discuss with you how the Anaconda Company controlled the papers in the state? Was there a some kind of a review process or a?
They selected their local editors, whatever they called them, whether they called them the editor or the managing editor or the publisher, whoever was in place, like here in Helena,
was
a publisher. They had their instructions. They got their instructions from Butte.
Okay.
And those instructions were followed.
Now, you're familiar, there's a law firm here in town, and one of the principal partners was a fellow by the name of Newell Goff.
Yep.
Well, in one of my interviews, it came up that he was important in terms of what they published in their papers and what they didn't publish.
Newell Goff might well have been. There was an unholy alliance, of course, between the power company and the Anaconda Company. I think Newell represented them both. I know he represented the power company, but he represented that interest, and I wouldn't be a bit surprised if Newell couldn't simply walk into the local Anaconda Company paper, the Independent Record, and tell them, we don't want to see anything about this story.
Or perhaps the editors of the other Anaconda Company papers, if they thought there was an important question about a story, might check with him before they published it?
I don't know whether they checked with Goff. I just don't know what relationship existed between Goff and the local papers.
Okay.
But I know this from Doc, what Doc told me. And that is, if there was any, the people who controlled the paper locally were educated in the first place on what the Anaconda Company liked.
Yeah.
But if they had any question, they'd pick up the phone and call Butte.
I see.
You could find out in Butte whether you could publish something or not.
Right.
Yeah. It was a controlled press. It was a control. Probably, I learned in, not here, but in Missouri, the University of Missouri Journalism School, that probably the most controlled press in the United States was Montana's.
Yeah. The Denver Post wrote a series of articles in 1952 about that.
Yeah.
About the.
Is that right?
Yes.
I don't think I saw that.
Yeah, it's a. Yeah. I've got copies of it. They're old and kind of hard to read, but I've read them pretty thoroughly. I had before I conducted my interview with him, I had Jerome Anderson read them.
Yeah.
And he was most interested. In fact, he was very absorbed in my presence. We postponed the interview for about an hour so he could carefully read those, and he was fascinated by them.
Jerry lived through all that.
Yeah, he lived through all of that. That's right. Any thoughts about the any additional thoughts about the Anaconda Company? You mentioned that the people were pretty well. They knew the Anaconda Company. I guess they knew the Anaconda Company owned the newspapers.
Oh yeah.
And there seemed to be.
That was common knowledge.
Yeah.
But it always amazed me after. Studying Montana history and experiencing it and talking to Doc Bowler and things like that, it always amazed me how unconcerned, for the most part, Montanans were about the controlled press.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't. But yeah, on the Great Falls Tribune, there was a great deal of vanity about being the uncontrolled press. The wardens were independent of everybody. It was a family newspaper. They ran it just like a country newspaper. And what Alex Warden said went. Well, what Bill Zadek, the city editor, said.
Yeah.
That was decided there on the newsroom floor, not somewhere else. And it was a good paper to work for.
And it worked harder at reporting the real news and not suppressing anything. It was your impression.
Let me put it this way, I don't want to be too specific. For the most part, they didn't suppress anything. If the reporter brought it in and if it was on a story, they'd run it. And I don't know of any. Alex Warden and Bob Warden, who was acting as managing editor, his brother Bob, they were very insistent on things like, you don't call it the Rainbow Hotel, you call it the Hotel Rainbow. And various sort of journalistic restrictions like that. But I was there with Scotty James. I don't know whether you know Scotty James or not, but Scotty was the editorial editor, but he was also he did a lot of reporting even when he was the editorial editor. And Scotty was with the Wardens his whole journalistic career, and he would fight with the Wardens. I'm not sure I want to record this, but he would get in terrible fights with Bob Warden about what went in and so on. But as far as policy was concerned, they weren't covering up anything. They weren't editorializing. It was almost, I spent 2 years studying how newspapers are supposed to run. A.J. Liebling, a commentator on newspapers, used to write in the New Yorker, said the problem with newspapers is the publishers don't go to journalism school. Well, they teach you at journalism school how newspapers are supposed to be run. And, the Great Falls Tribune, when I was as close to a model newspapers you could run into.
Now, you know, another newspaper in Montana that prided itself as it being independent of the control of the Anaconda Company was a little weekly here in Helena called The People's Voice. It was edited by Harry and Gretchen Billings. How would you compare that paper to the Great Falls Tribune? Both prided themselves in their independence.
Oh, well. And they were entitled. I knew Harry Billings very well. Harry and Gretchen were some of my best friends. Yeah. Totally independent. But they didn't come from the same place. Harry was a bomb-throwing liberal. You know, he didn't make any bones about it. Lee Metcalf and the labor movement and so on made it possible for Harry to be just as independent as he wanted to be because he was their kind of guy. But unquestioned liberal, pretty far over on the left end. Anti-corporation, didn't like corporations. Hated the Anaconda Company. Harry knew how to hate. He also knew how to love. But he had positions on almost everything. And everything political, everything public policy and so on. He had a position on those things. And they were strong positions and they were well thought out positions. He was, he ran a little shop. It was Harriet and it was Gretchen and Harry that got out the paper, essentially. They didn't have any reporters. They did the reporting, they did the editing. They even, Harry could help set it up in lead. You know, he could run a linotype. And he did everything around the shop, in reporting and everything else. Wrote the editorials, mm-hmm. wrote the news stories and so on. Hardest working newsman I've ever known. He killed himself working. There aren't many people that kill themselves working. He retired, but he was essentially a broken guy from overwork.
Mm-hmm.
But for about 15 or 20 years, he was an entirely different voice than any of the newspapers.
Including the Great Falls Tribune.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Because they were independent of the corporations, but he was a journalist advocate than he
right.
was a...
He was an advocate.
Uh-huh.
The Great Falls Tribune was never a great advocate. Never has been, never is, mm-hmm. is now. Some people say it is, but that's baloney. The Great Falls Tribune has never been an advocate, never wanted to be an advocate particularly, except on the editorial page.
Mm-hmm.
Scotty James was an advocate, but he wasn't anything like Harry.
Mm-hmm. Harry Billings. Yeah.
Harry Billings. Nothing like him.
Now, Judge Bennett, you have the reputation of being somewhat of a philosopher yourself. We talked about Don Chapman.
Yeah.
And in the process of your life in Montana, you've paid attention to a lot of issues and also you've known a lot of people. And I'm going to ask you some of the political figures, some of the major political figures you may have come in contact with. You just mentioned Senator Lee Metcalf. I presume you probably knew him personally. Do you have any impressions, any stories to tell about him?
You want to have another interview, or?
Well, just
I know quite a bit about Lee Metcalf.
Well,
I was the nominal campaign manager for him twice. Lee was a statesman. Lee was a guy that was very hard to get along with. He was a very opinionated guy, but a very well-informed guy. He was a, certainly no one would question he was a liberal. But he wasn't an off-the-board liberal at all. His positions, as far as I could tell, were about as well thought out as anybody's positions could be. He was a tireless worker, personally almost unambitious, personally, but politically as ambitious as you can be. He wanted to make changes. He didn't go to Washington, and he didn't go to the Supreme Court of Montana, and he didn't go to the legislature to be a member.
Yeah.
He was not a member. He was an advocate from the ground up. He decided what ought to be done and what shouldn't be done. And once he figured that out, he was a tough advocate. The contrast between him and Mike Mansfield would make a marvelous book, about the contrast between two great statesmen. Now, Mike Mansfield, everybody will agree absolutely that he was a great statesman. Everybody in the Senate agreed with that when he was there, on both sides of the aisle. He was a statesman, the like of which you haven't got in the Senate anymore. He would have been pretty handy around there in the last 6 months. He was a great, recognized a great statesman. But Lee Metcalf was a different kind of statesman. But he was a great statesman, in my view. I'm prejudiced.
Well, and I know that. Now, once I think I remember some reading something about Metcalf, and I think this, he himself said, if you look at our records, there's very little difference in our voting records.
That's true.
Between Mansfield and myself. And yet, every time the election cycle comes up, Mansfield has an easy time of it, and I have the fight of my life.
That's right.
Why? And it sounds like if their voting records were similar, then their philosophies were similar.
Well,
I mean, they were.
It points out a very basic thing, and that is the elector doesn't know how they're voting. For one thing, you begin with that, and then Mike Mansfield had this genius about not stirring up people. Mike Mansfield, for instance, it's wonderful to read Caro's book on how Lyndon Johnson ran the Senate. But while he was doing all that, Mike Mansfield Lyndon Johnson was kind of the Lee Metcalf kind of guy.
You're speaking of Master of the Senate?
Master of the Senate.
By Robert Caro.
Yeah.
Lyndon B. Johnson was the majority leader in the U.S. Senate, and at that time, Mike Mansfield was the assistant majority leader, or the whip.
That's right.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. But that, you can contrast those two, much as you can contrast Lee Metcalf and Mike Mansfield. Mike Mansfield didn't have terribly fervent followers. He just had a whole lot more followers than Lee did.
Yeah.
But Mike Mansfield didn't make people mad. He wasn't interested in making people mad. He was interested in getting a consensus.
And yet his philosophy, by the record, seems to be pretty similar to Metcalf's.
Very similar. The record is very, very similar. But Lee fought for things. Mansfield did what was possible. Mansfield would take a shrewd look at something and see what's possible and work it out from there. Lee Metcalf figured out what should be done, and he didn't give much of a damn what was possible. He figured out if you needed an environmental measure like water or air, clean air, and so on, he was ready to fight the enemies of it. Mike was willing to promote it and get it done if it was possible. And they made quite a team, and the book ought to be a little about that. The book, a marvelous book, and I hope somebody writes it. Mike was a master of the possible. And Lee was the just almost total advocate. And the two of them made a wonderful combination. You know, the combination is demonstrated by this. When Lee went back to Congress, the first thing Lee hooked into was the rules of the House. And then when he went to the Senate, he hooked into the rules of the Senate. Lee knew more about those. You have Senator Byrd of West Virginia, who knows more about the customs and the rules of the Senate than anybody alive today, and probably maybe more than anybody that ever lived. But Lee Metcalf was a good second. Lee Metcalf knew how the rules of the Senate worked. He'd studied them. He put a lot of time in on studying the rules of the Senate. So when Mike had, you know, presiding over the Senate is a kind of a no-brainer. You sit there and a clerk tells you what to say, and everybody, they just barely are able to stay awake. But when Mike wanted somebody who could manage the thing from the chair, when he wanted somebody in the chair who knew the rules and could help him with the rules, Lee Metcalf was there more often when Lee was alive and working than anybody else in the Senate, because Mike depended on him. And Lee depended on Mike. There's all kinds of people, I think, in the Senate, don't quote me on this, that wouldn't talk to Lee. Lee wouldn't hesitate if some senator from Nebraska, and he had one particular one that he loved to hate.
From Nebraska?
Yeah. Ruska. Ruska of Nebraska.
Roman L. Ruska?
Roman L. Ruska. Lee used to say, you know, being a senator isn't very complicated at all. If you know where Roman Ruska is, and if you vote the other way, you're not going to be wrong very often. Well, he would stand out in the hall and say to Roman Ruska as loud as he could in the presence of all the others, "That's the stupidest goddamn thing I ever heard." He wasn't a friend, man. He wasn't out to make friends. He was out to make law. And he knew an awful lot of law. He was one of the best lawyers that ever walked in Montana. He was a brilliant lawyer. He knew how to make law. He knew how law was going to be interpreted. Mike depended on him entirely. If there was a constitutional question about something that was going through the Senate, Mike would sit down and talk to Lee about it. He was a great lawyer, but he was a lousy politician. He was a little like my good friend Forrest Anderson. When he's campaigning, I used to think somebody ought to be along with Lee just to keep him away from people. I thought the same thing about, don't quote me on this, about Forrest Anderson. In fact, Forrest Anderson had a guy with him that his principal purpose was to keep Forrest away from some kinds of people. They're lousy retail politicians, both of them. Person-to-person politician.
And yet they were both quite successful.
Very successful.
I don't think either one of them ever lost an election, in fact.
Let me see. I don't think, no, I think you're right. I don't think either, you know, that doesn't occur to me, but they never had.
Mike Mansfield was defeated a couple of times for Congress before he...
Once.
Was it just once?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And Morin wouldn't let him quit. I heard that from Morin.
So,
but anyway.
This is fascinating to me. I had two different conversations with Senator Metcalf. Both of them were good. But boy, I'll tell you, In my interviews, you know, I've asked other people about Senator Metcalf and the volatility of his temper and the almost frightening, angry outbursts that
tower,
come up before.
Towering.
He was a large man physically, I know that, and apparently he could be a towering volcano when he was angry. I've not seen that, but maybe you have, I don't know.
Yeah.
I've
seen it. He could, but you ask how he had a couple of wonderful assistants that stuck with. We had four or five assistants that wouldn't work for anybody else in the world, and he'd exploded in front of all of them. The thing that kept them together is they knew that the next day Lee would be around and say, "Gee, I'm sorry I talked about that." You know,
yeah.
They loved him. They loved the people that worked with him, loved him almost with a passion. They would do anything for him. They'd walk on water for him if they could. But he had this violent, violent temper. I don't know from whence it came. Nobody knows from whence
now
it came.
Now, he was a outspoken critic of the Montana Power Company.
More than a critic.
Okay, and so I guess maybe that's kind of where I'm heading with this question. Was there more to that than meets the eye? Was it a philosophical thing purely, or was there seemed to be almost a personal thing there?
There was, but it isn't, you know. One time somebody from the power company offered him a plane ride to somebody. And he said, "Do you think I'm crazy?" There was an animosity there. There was a kind of a formal animosity. It was a two-sided thing. To answer your question, he had a terrible thing with Bob Corrette, for instance.
Now, Bob Corrette was a lawyer and a prominent official with the Montana Power Company.
Yeah, and I think he was a law school classmate, in law school at the same time Lee was. The power company, in Lee's view, well, he wrote a book about it, so I don't have to speculate.
Poles
about
Apart,
it.
I think.
Pardon?
Or Overcharge.
Overcharge.
Overcharge, yeah.
Vic Reinemer wrote it, essentially.
Yeah.
But
and Vic Reinemer was a staff person with Senator Metcalf.
He's one of those staff persons that Lee would blow up from time to time, but Vic Reinemer would have given his life for Lee. Anyway, the animosity started, the personal animosity, I think, started in law school with Bob Corrette.
Okay.
And then Jack Corrette, you know, went to the University of Virginia, and he was kind of an aristocrat. One thing Lee didn't like was aristocrats. So he kind of didn't like him personally, but he loved to fight with them because they were wily. They were his kind of guy, really. They represented something entirely different than he did, but they were both fighters, sort of, and they liked to fight. I heard all kinds of criticism from Lee about those people, but I never found any real bitterness, not what you'd call bitterness, personal bitterness. But he was in a contest with them, a do-or-die contest with them all the time. And Lee came from this cooperative background, public power background, and so on. And anybody that was with public power did not sit well with the Correttes, did not sit well with the power company. And he wasn't just mad at the local guys. He understood that Goldman Sachs, to quite an extent, ran the Montana Power Company. He understood where, you read the book, he understood where these guys coming from, the big New York financiers.
Is it any coincidence that Senator Mansfield went to work for Goldman and Sachs after he...
I'm not knowledgeable about that at all. I wasn't surprised the least bit, because Mike had something that the Goldman Sachs wanted, and that is an enormous knowledge of how the Far East worked. And Goldman Sachs, at the time they hired Mike, was counseling all kinds of people at very, very high prices about moving their industry to the Far East.
But there is the Montana connection, and Goldman and Sachs was involved in the so-called electrical deregulation business.
Yeah, intimately.
Well, Senator Mansfield was still living and working for them. And you know, you don't know if this is coincidental or not, but it's hard to imagine, isn't it, Senator Metcalf going to work for Goldman and Sachs? And yet, like we've discussed earlier, their records in the U.S. Senate were very similar.
Yeah.
And yet, your response was what I...
Goldman Sachs, like Mike, are pragmatists.
Yeah, okay.
I would guess that Mike had nothing whatever to do with the development of deregulation with the power company. Mike never had much of anything to do with the power company. He stayed away from the power company. Lee is the one that short-circuited the power company all the time. But I can understand, if I were running Goldman Sachs, I'd hire Mike at almost any price when they hired him, because the industry of the United States was beginning to move to the Far East. This great movement that's on was on. And there wasn't anybody, any American, that was more politically astute about the Far East on his record by demonstration than Mike Mansfield was. He did a marvelous job, which hasn't been fully accounted for, as ambassador to Tokyo. The Tokyo embassy was the Far East embassy. It wasn't just a Japanese embassy. It ran the Far East, and Mike was there running it. And if I were Goldman Sachs and the business of the country was going to the Far East, I'd hire Mike Mansfield, and I think that's why they hired him. That's all speculation.
Sure.
I don't know. I never talked to Mike about it, never talked to any. Well, I talked to Ray Dockstader about it a little bit.
I see. What did Ray think? Same thing?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And Ray Dockstader was another top staffer for Senator Metcalf.
No. Dockstader.
Oh, for Mansfield. That's right. Yeah, for Mansfield. That's right. I do remember now. Yeah, that's right. You mentioned, Judge Bennett, you mentioned Governor Anderson, Forrest Anderson, and that his personality was similar to Metcalf's. But I think when people think of Metcalf, I can say this. My dad was always very devout Republican, and I never heard my dad do anything more than maybe a low grumble about Mike Mansfield. But my dad could get table-thumping angry about Lee Metcalf.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't think Anderson, you don't think of him as being a statesman like people regarded Mansfield, and you don't think of him as being a do-or-die man for principle like you think of Metcalf. You think of him as more of a practical, pragmatic sort of a person. How would you describe
Anderson? Well, much closer to Mansfield than he was to Mike, not to Lee.
Personality-wise, he was more like Metcalf, but...
No, personality was more like...
Metcalf, but philosophically maybe more like Mansfield.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to put words in your mouth.
No, his pragmatism was very similar to that of Mike's.
Okay.
And that is, you get done what you can get done.
Yeah.
That's where Forrest Anderson came from. Nothing was more fundamental to Forrest than you don't take on anything, you don't take on everybody like Lee did. You don't make any more enemies than you have to, because what you're in public office for is to get things done.
Mm-hmm.
And he liked to get things done. And he would go to far greater lengths to get things done than Lee would ever do. And I think Mike would ever do. Forrest got an awful lot done in his 4 years as governor. And the reason he got it done is that basic pragmatism that he had. He didn't, you know, he ran as a Democrat, and some people might have called him a liberal. He wasn't any of those things, you know, particularly at all. Forrest was Forrest, and he, throughout his career, if he had to deal with Republic, I don't know what your experience was, you may have dealt with him.
Well, he was still governor my first session in the legislature.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I had a... Actually, I knew him best because his son Newell and I were college classmates.
All right.
We went to college at the same time. Newell went to college at Northern, and I went to college at Montana State. But as it turned out, we were both student body presidents.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so Newell was kind of the most interesting student body president because his dad was governor at the time.
Yeah.
And this was before I entered the legislature. But anyway, I met him through Newell.
Yeah.
And so I knew him kind of as Newell Anderson's dad to begin with.
Well, do you have an impression from being in the legislature what the legislature thought of Forrest? And I don't know exactly.
Well, I was there in 71 when there was a big impasse over the sales tax.
Yeah.
And the Republicans were trying to get some kind of a tax reform based on the sales tax through the legislature, and they were willing to compromise almost anything to get it.
Mm-hmm.
And the Democrats saw it, I think, as a good political issue and were willing to do almost anything to keep the Republicans from getting it passed. And we regarded Governor Anderson as kind of the evil architect of killing the sales tax under any circumstances, regardless of what was good for Montana, in the background. That's how I remembered him that way. I don't remember him very favorably, actually.
Yeah. When it came to the sales tax, he was a good Democrat.
Yeah.
He was against the sales tax.
And it was good
tax.
Politics to be against the sales tax.
I think it was good politics at that time to be, it was good politics.
And he correctly recognized that.
Yeah, I think he recognized that also in the 70s. We demonstrated it. I was, you probably don't remember, I was Bradley's campaign manager, and Bradley had been for the sales tax and so on. The sales tax was carried around as a huge load by the Democratic Party for a long, long time, and it's probably still is, and it was a pivotal issue and all that. I don't see why the Democrats let that get to be such a pivotal issue. They could have gotten a lot further if they hadn't. But anyway, one of the things that influenced Forrest is that while he was not a bomb-throwing Democrat or bomb-throwing Republican, he came from the Democratic Party, and the Democratic Party elected him, and the Democratic Party was against the sales tax, and to that extent, pragmatically, he was against the sales tax.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not so sure at heart he was all that against the sales tax, but...
Remember, too, pay more, what for? That was his slogan, and that was basically, I think, aimed at the sales tax. That's how I think it was understood, anyway. So
we invented that.
Oh, is that right?
I was in on that. But anyway, I'll tell you a little story about pay more, what for. We were up at Malta and campaigning for governor. And it was Phillips County Fair. And we went into the dusty arena there, and Forrest made a sort of an appearance, which he didn't like to do, and he hung around there and talked to these farmers for a while, and said, well, that's about all of this I can take.
Right to them, to their faces?
No, to me and Bob Ruby, and said, let's go over to the Great Northern and have a cup of coffee. So we went over to the Great Northern and sat down in the coffee shop. This bow-legged irrigator came along. Tight Levi pants and cowboy hat, and you could tell that he was one of those Milk River irrigators that had a few cows and so on. But he was very aggressive. He came walking over to the table and he invited himself into our little clutch. Forrest didn't invite him at all. And he pulled the chair around, swung the chair around, sat down on it, and looked at Forrest like that. See, you're Anderson, ain't you? Forrest says, yeah. You're the guy that's running for governor? Yeah. Well, here's one thing I want to know. If there's a sales tax, will it apply to binder twine? Forrest looked at him like that for about not 5 minutes, but he looked at him for a couple of minutes, and he said, yeah, it will. And the guy pulled his chair away and walked back to the bar and said, that's all I want to know. And Forrest says, there isn't anything in this campaign beside the sales tax. He says, I don't want to hear anything more about anything but the sales tax. This is a sales tax campaign. He says, I'll bet you the farmers from border to border here are wondering whether it's going to apply to binder twine, new machinery, and everything like that. He says, we're not going to say anything about that. We're just going to say, we're going to work out a slogan about the sales tax, and we're going to do it. You know, Karl Rove, who is the political genius of our time, has these great principles, and that is, you have one or two, at the most two issues, and you stay on it, on the issue. Well, that was Forrest all over. He didn't want to hear about any other issues.
Babcock had been an advocate of the sales tax.
Yeah.
And Forrest saw that as Babcock's Achilles heel if he just kept focused on
That's
it.
That's all we did.
Yeah.
That's all we did for about 3 months, the sales tax. And that's how it came about. We were talking about all kinds of great social things and so on before that, and we were sending out pamphlets with 15, 20 ideas and great principles and so on. And Forrest, on the way back, said, we're all through with that other bullshit. that's how the sales tax issue developed. It's just this bull-legged irrigator up at Alder.
You obviously knew Governor Judge.
Yeah.
Any thoughts or impressions?
Hmm?
Any thoughts or impressions about Governor Judge?
Oh, yeah. The relationship between Judge and Anderson wasn't very good. Judge, again, was a pragmatist, however, and I think consciously made quite a study of Mike Mansfield. He wasn't, he believed in what you call democratic, large D, democratic principles. He was a good Democrat. For instance, environmental stuff, he was as good a Democrat as you'd find, as you know, as you experience. He was softer. He was ambitious. I think Tom wanted to go to the Senate. Made an enormous mistake by trying to get a third term. I don't know why he tried to get a third term. I wasn't that close to Tom, but knew him well. But I didn't campaign with Tom and so on. But much softer guy, a pragmatist, politician to the core, smart, pretty smart. He worked with the legislators much better than Forrest did. Forrest had to send emissaries. And he knew how to pick people. He knew how to lobby. He would pick people. He would pick lobbyists. To get what he wanted done in the legislature, he knew what lobbyists would do it or who could help him in the legislature. But Tom was better working with the legislature person to person by far than Forrest.
And of course, Tom had served in the legislature, in the House and the Senate. And,
yeah.
And Forrest Anderson had, but years ago, I think, in the House, which is one term or something.
And he hadn't made much of a. I was in the Attorney General's office for 2 years during two sessions of the legislature. Well, one session of the legislature, I was in the Attorney General's office. The other session of the legislature, I was chairman of what they call the Unemployment Compensation Commission. So I watched Forrest with the legislature, watched him how he worked, and I also watched how Tom worked, and they were quite different in their approach to the legislature. Again, both, I guess the hallmark of a successful politician is pragmatism. They were pragmatic. Tom would go as far as he could, but he didn't try to push anybody much.
So of the public figures we've discussed in our interview today, Metcalf is really, you've used the term pragmatist more or less to characterize everyone else.
That's
they
right.
All had a pragmatic side, and you've never used that in regard to Metcalf. I mean, maybe he had a pragmatic side, but certainly it was
Lee was at war all the time. He was pragmatic as far as the war was concerned, the tactics and so on. He could intellectually comprehend how you lobbied something, and if he could get people to work with him on that theory, that was fine. But as a person-to-person lobbyist, he wasn't outstanding. I would
Bennett. Judge Bennett, is there any other public figure or any other issue or anything? We've got a relatively short amount of time left on our tape here that we haven't discussed. I guess we haven't talked about Arnold Olson, and I don't know if you have thoughts or impressions about him, Congressman Olson, or
very little
someone in the legislature perhaps that particularly stands out in your memory that. Any other public figure, maybe a Supreme Court justice or anyone?
No. I don't have any great thoughts. I wish I could tell you, and you know more about it than I do, I expect. The great thing that's happened in our time was the Constitutional Convention, and I didn't have very much to do with that. I had a short-tail relative who is unsung. Her name was Mrs. Spear.
Lucille Spear.
Lucille Spear. She was a short-tail relative of mine. She had much more to do with it than anybody concedes, but I saw that thing pretty much through Lucille's eyes, but I didn't have much to do with it, and that's, I don't say a regret I have, but I really wish I'd been more involved. That was an exciting time.
Yeah.
That was an exciting thing that happened. It's the most exciting thing governmentally that happened in my time,
yeah.
I'm sure.
And of course, Governor Anderson was pretty important in terms of making sure that got ultimately approved. There was a case that came before the Supreme Court that challenged whether it received a majority of the votes. And I think...
Did you ever talk to Duke Crowley about that?
No, but he is someone I'm going to interview.
Ask him about this. There came a time when it came time for the Board of... what they call it. It used to be the Secretary of State and the...
Board of Examiners.
The Board of Examiners. Was supposed to sign, the Board of Examiners was supposed to sign the new Constitution. And Murray, the Secretary of State, who sought interest too, he was on the Board of Examiners, of course. And he was a very guarded guy. I don't know whether he knew Frank Murray or not. He was a very guarded guy, hesitated to do anything. And the litigation had occurred. And Lee Metcalf got John Conway Harrison to go along with the Constitution. That's what made the Constitution possible. And it came time for the governor and the Secretary of State and the Attorney General to sign the darn thing. And so Forrest was sort of stage managing it, like he'd backroomed the whole Constitutional Convention. He didn't get into it. He worked with Grable and those people, but he didn't want to get into it. This was a nonpartisan thing that was going to develop whether he liked it or not. He wasn't elected to rig the Constitutional Convention, though, but he was there all the time. And now it was time to sign the Constitution. And he signed the Constitution, and he carried it into
Woodall?
The Secretary's. Uh-huh. Secretary of State's office.
Frank Murray, yeah.
Yeah. And Frank said, well, I don't know whether I want to sign that or not. I don't know that you signed that.
Oh, he hadn't actually witnessed him to sign it.
Hadn't witnessed him sign it.
Oh.
So, Forrest Anderson signed it a second time and said, now sign the goddamn thing.
So his signature's on it twice.
I think you'll find that Forrest Anderson's signature's on it twice.
Oh,
talk to Duke about
that's
it.
That's a good story.
Talk to Duke. Now sign the goddamn. That's how the Constitution was born.
I'll be darned.
Anyway, that's probably all. I don't know of anything particularly. The older I get, the more I go on about everything, but I don't really know that I don't know whether I've given you any significant information. But,
well, it's been... been really good to visit with you, and appreciate the your service, your public service, in the time that you've been involved, Judge Bennett.
Minor service.
Thank you very much.
You bet.